Major Highfield, Reel 4. We're talking about after the phony war had ended, and you stayed in position for the first few days, not moving. What happened next?
Well, orders eventually came to move, and we moved into Belgium and to the area of Gramont, Grammont, and started to deploy and dig in. We'd only been there 24 hours when we were ordered to move back to the next river line further west, which was the Escaut River. And we moved back to there. The Belgian people were very welcoming to us. And we'd only been in the Escaut position for 24 hours when we were moved back to France, more or less to where we started from.
Now, did anything happen during, these movements?
There was no enemy activity because we were not in contact with the enemy. We were preparing positions for the forward troops to come through. But each time the plan changed, and this was because of the breakthrough at Sedan, and the German armour was already moving south of Arras, I beg your pardon, towards the coast.
So what happened next?
We then we did a certain amount of firing, but basically they decided to deploy our guns on the canal line La Basse to Béthune, which is some 20 miles. And an 18-pounder gun and a 4-5 howitzer, which was the armament of the other battery, were placed on most of the bridge crossings as direct fire positions.
Now, whereabouts were you put?
I had to deliver rations to these gun positions daily, and it took me the whole day to get round doing this. When I got there, they were mostly very well fed, being off the local with the local people, and the whole place now was getting totally congested with civilian traffic moving in all directions, going south. They didn't really know which way to go. They were thinking of the First World War, when if they put everything in the and got in a cart and got the children, grandma and everything, they could go west and get out of it. And they had started, and they didn't really know where they were going.
You could see these on the roads everywhere.
Well, the roads were jammed, absolutely. And by now, the German Air Force was overhead, and there was quite a bit of bombing of selective crossroads, mostly by Heinkel 111 bombers, flying at a very low altitude, say 2,000 feet.
Now, were you involved in any such incident? I mean, or was it just something you knew was happening and so?
It happened all around you. There were certain particular crossroads you got to know and avoid. And if you could, if the planes came over, you stopped what you were doing and pulled into the side.
And so, what dates would you be on the canal? Your unit. Do you know roughly?
Well, let me tell you about the 151 Brigade, because they had a very effective role to play. They were the counter-attack force with a French formation, which was going to try and close the gap from Arras south and cut off the German forces. And they did do an attack which was not unsuccessful, and which ran into a German division commanded by Rommel.
Now, what was, did your unit supply supporting fire for the 151 Brigade?
No, they were. We could see the area about 5 or 10 miles away from us, and eventually they attracted the German dive bombers. They got bombed and they had to withdraw. But it was one of the major offensive units done, is separately described, and the 151 Brigade took quite a number of prisoners. We saw the prisoners actually march back, being brought back up the road at Le Bassé, which is interesting. And we noted they'd got medal ribbons, some of them, which were given for the Polish campaign.
Now, I should have asked earlier, well, you know, each little bridge, they had the howitzer and the 18-pounder. Had they actually dug them in? Could you describe the sort of gun positions they dug in? I know you were only visiting them with food, but, I mean, we're quite interested in what level of digging in or preparation.
These were direct fire positions, which the 18-pounder Mark II was probably quite efficient at. But eventually, when the Germans came up to the canal, the A troop gun was on the Le Bassé bridge and engaged and did some damage, but was then knocked out. They put barges together on the canal. The tanks went straight across these barges, and then we had to withdraw then. The regiment assembled, and they had a bit more to do. They did some firing at a place called Gondicourt.
Gondicourt?
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
Neuve Chapelle. And really, after that, we had been detached from the 50th Div, and the decision was coming very fast that we would, the Belgian army was about to lay down its arms, and that we would have to get out via Dunkirk.
Now, what do you remember of the action at Neuve Chapelle? Were you there, or were you doing your... You seem to have been put onto a supply role.
That was on the canal line, but when they regrouped. But it was only a day's action, and we were... I don't think we had OPs out. I think we were being supporting other OPs.
So what were you doing? You were just at the gun position?
At the command post.
And nothing particular that you remember?
Not very special. And after that, they decided they'd got to get certain people withdrawn to Dunkirk quickly, and 2nd Division was decided must go back. And because we'd been on the canal line, we were attached to 2nd Division, and so we started to move towards Dunkirk. We got as far as just south of Baileuil, Baileuil, and this was heavily dive-bombed. The roads were completely crowded, and the whole thing had come to a halt. The regiment was in one group on the road, and I was told by my battery commander to go down a side road and to prospect as far as I could to see if there was any way of getting round the jam. By the time I got back to the main road, the column had moved in some way, and I was left on my own and never rejoined the regiment.
So it was just you and your truck and...
No, I was on foot. And Baileuil was in flames, and so I then realised we had a very bad habit in the unit of putting our full equipment on the seat in the car and then just walking out. This is what I had done. So I then had to realise that I'd better get myself equipped. I'm afraid a certain amount of stuff was being abandoned already. I managed to equip myself with a rifle. I got on a truck and I got two bandoliers of 50 rounds each. I managed to pick up a great coat because that would keep me warm at night. And I also picked up one haversack and one water bottle. And I managed to get a tin of bully beef and a tin of carnation milk, and that was my iron ration. And on that, I then proceeded on the truck I was on towards Dunkirk. Somehow we moved after dark, and we seemed to bypass Balliol. I don't quite know what happened. And then the next day, very soon, you were driving towards Dunkirk, and you were being directed into fields.
Now, whose lorry were you on? Just
I can't remember.
Just a lorry?
Just a military lorry, and they were... It helped me. And we were told to drive into these fields and then to smash up as much of the truck as you could, the engine block and so on, and then march to the beach. And...
Now, had you actually witnessed or been under a Stuka attack yet?
No, that was to come.
Right, sorry. So what happened when you got to Dunkirk? Do you know about what date it was when you got to Dunkirk?
Yes, I should think it was about the 26th of May, something like that.
And whereabouts in Dunkirk did you go? To the beach or to the...
No, we came down pretty well close to the harbour, and just north of the harbour, and... There's a wide beach there, and there was a huge queue. Well, people camped all over the beach in a sort of huge snake of people. And we looked out to sea, and there were some ships out to sea, the odd destroyer and so on. But they were being dive bombed quite regularly, and the Dunkirk port was in flames, so the oil tanks had been hit, and there was a huge pall of smoke coming up over it. I can remember walking along the front. You kept your people kept the place in the queue, and you could go for a walk. And we did that. And the outlook looked very poor. Every now and again, they would bomb the ships out at sea, and it didn't seem to be much was happening at all.
Were you nervous? I mean, yourself.
I think you just... There was so many other people there in the same boat. I think you just wait to see what's going to happen. Anyway, the next day came and dawned, and this was different. And I think probably this was one of the days on which the RAF squadrons had been put overhead of the beach because we didn't get any dive bombing. And they also, the plan that Churchill had authorised to use 15 of the older destroyers and to run them right up alongside the mole at Dunkirk, was going to be put into effect. And slowly that day, we moved towards the mole, and somewhere about 2 o'clock, we got onto a destroyer alongside the mole. One of the V-class. They took 800 men on the destroyer, 500 below decks, and 300 sitting with your back to the superstructure all round the top. And then we were just about to cast off, and a Wellington bomber came overhead, flying very low. I presume had been trying to bomb one of the bridges which the Germans were using inland. The high-angle AK gun on the destroyer fired 4 rounds because it was assumed there were no friendly aircraft before it could stop, but fortunately no damage. And then we went off top speed. We went from Dunkirk to Dover in 3 hours, and we were given a huge mug of tea and a very large bully beef sandwich.
Now, what was it like on the boat there? It's very overcrowded on the destroyer.
I was on deck, one of the 300 back, and you looked, and 3 hours and we were in Dover.
And this is the 27th?
I think it was about the 27th, yes. Because the evacuation went on actually up till, I think, the 2nd of June. But 2nd Div and units with it was being moved first.
Now, what was the reception you got at Dover? Dover, you said it was Dover, didn't you?
Dover, yes.
What was the reception like you got there? You got your sarnie and...
Well, we got there and there were several trains in the station and you were just told to go to a train and get in. And there were ladies with tea and things brewing up. Everybody was very welcoming and you were just very, very tired because you hadn't slept for a long time, really.
Well, how about this? How tired were you? Can you give us an idea of what the fatigue was like?
Well, once you were released from the business of saying, now, what do I do next, or what have I got to look at, and what should I be doing, and were just a unit moving safely, you let go and you could go to sleep anywhere. And eventually the trains took off from the station at Dover, and I remember we had about... I slept on the... I was on the floor because all the seats were taken up, and I slept. And every station that you went through, there were ladies and lights on offering you tea and stuff. But I remember waking up in the night and I realised I was at Clapham Junction, because I knew Clapham Junction station very well from my boyhood. And then we went to sleep again and we finished up detraining and going to a camp at Tidworth.
Now, you were very much on your own. You were not part of the unit.
That's right. You were completely on my own.
So what happened when you got to Tidworth?
Well, we were looked after, and in point of fact, that they ran the trains all over the country to all over various places. And it was probably about another week or 10 days they started to get concentration points for units. And the concentration point decided for 50th Division was at... Knutsford in Cheshire.
And what happened when you got there? What state was your unit in, the 74th?
Well, I was put on... There was tentage, there was wooden tables and that sort of thing, and you waited for people to concentrate. And it probably took about a fortnight for the concentration. And I can remember some new officers who had just completed their first training course in an octave. Five officers were posted to the regiment, and I was sitting at the reception table and booked them in as they came through. And one of them was a great friend, subsequently a great friend of mine, called Van. I called him Van. Stone was his name. Van and Stone, and we always called him Van. But he was to become the survey officer in the regiment. I was to become the assistant adjutant. And for 18 months, subsequently, we were always sharing the same room or billet or whatever. And from Knutsford...
How much of the unit congregated? I mean, what was the state of the unit?
The state was remarkably good, and there were not many casualties. And so eventually we had something like 500 men in Knutsford and officers.
But obviously no equipment?
No, absolutely nothing. And from there we were moved down to the Dorset coast and into a couple of tented camps.
Whereabouts?
Not far from Dorchester. And we started to assemble.
This would be June?
Yes. and various bits of, we had one or two buses provided. Things were, it was civilian transport, there was no military transport. We had rifles, and it was, the theory was that you could move a platoon of a platoon's worth of people in a coach. And that was about it for the time being.
Were you actually assigned to a coastal defence or anti-parachute role, or were you just really not given any
rights? We had no equipment.
But I mean, were you treated as infantry, or you didn't?
Well, we were allotted an area. That they allotted the sector to the 50th Division from Portland to Bridport to defend that beach. And the infantry were assembling in the same sort of way, and we were assembling a bit further back, but hadn't got any guns. Eventually, we received two guns, and these guns had been captured by the Navy from the Germans in the Norwegian campaign. They were being moved on barges to Norway, and they were German 105mm. And they were given to the senior troop and deployed at the end of the Chesil Bank near Portland, and they had 100 rounds of ammunition with each gun.
Fairly desperate measures.
That's right.
Did anyone have any opinion of the 105mm gun? I mean, as to how it compared with our, say, 18-pounder?
Well, I think it was a perfectly good field gun. 105 is a heavier shell than the 25-pounder, but they were only allowed to fire about 6 rounds in practice. Of course, the rest was saved for when they possible if the Germans were going to come and invade us. So that was that.
Now, had you taken up your adjutant role at this time, or what was your role in the unit, just, you know,
About this time I was called in to be assistant adjutant.
Could you tell us what your job was as assistant adjutant? I know it's to assist the adjutant, but I mean, what exactly did that entail?
Well, it entailed really being the officer in charge of the men who made up RHQ, regimental headquarters. In other words, signallers, drivers, and so on and so forth. And I was their troop officer. I also had to assist the adjutant in running the office, and so on, and if you're on a live situation, well, then the regimental office had to be manned night and day for receiving and giving orders.
Now, what was the composition of the office? You know, I mean, what did it consist of?
Well, we were all billeted in, we were billeted in the village of Winterbourne Abbas, actually. And this is four miles from Dorchester, Winterbourne Abbas. And we were billeted in various private houses. I think that small post office was taken over as RHQ. And the vehicles were put in a farmyard when we got them. But it was some time before we got them.
So who were the people that made, see what I mean, who made up the headquarters?
Well, you had the colonel and the second in command. And then you had the adjutant who distributed the orders of the colonel to the batteries. And you had a signals officer and so on. And really, we were stuck there until we got some equipment.